A Wednesday Evening Lenten Sermon, preached by Reverend Richard A. Rem at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 27, 2002, in the series, The Grace to Let Go, entitled, Of the Need to Win. The texts for the sermon are Matthew 16, verses 13 through 23, and chapter 26, verses 69 through 75, and John 21, verses 15 through 23. Copyright Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there is some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
The grace to let go is our Lenten theme in these midweek services this year. The grace to let go in a variety of life's circumstances. Symbolized by the open hand, the extended hand. The hand is a sign of openness, of grace, of receptivity, as opposed to the clenched fist, which even in the clenching of it brings a tautness to our body and a tension. A good sign of the tension and the tautness with which we live so much of our lives. The clenched fist, which is a sign of that defensiveness with which we live and that fear with which we live. A clenched fist, which is a good sign of those survival instincts that we gathered through the eons of time as we moved in the evolutionary emergence from the jungle to our present pre-human state. The clenched fist by which we have protected ourselves, defended ourselves, and threatened any who would oppose us. It's simply a sign, but it is a good sign of how we live much of our lives, as opposed to that open hand that is beckoning and that extends the possibility of communion and community. And tonight, the grace to let go of the need to win. The need to win. In my scribblings, as I was thinking about these weeks, I had put it down several different ways of the need to be number one, or of the need to be right, or you might name a few other possibilities. That need to win. And as I thought about it, it's not such a simple matter, really, because winning is not bad. Winning has a positive aspect to it. How could I say anything else after 2 weeks of the Olympic Games in which we were hoping for our national representatives to win? And winning in such a setting is a wonderful thing. It is the achievement of the goal for hard work and long practice and the preparations necessary to get to such a point at which one can prove one's skills and bring home the gold. Not all bad, really. That's not a negative thing at all when it's in the context of honest competition and the playfulness of the game. And of course, winning is not a negative either when you think in terms of, for example, leadership. I suppose that there's never been a leader that really didn't want to win. And leadership is a gift. There is a gift of leadership. I think about a couple of our presidents in the past, the recent past, somewhat recent past. As a human being, I admired Jimmy Carter a great deal, much more than I do Ronnie Reagan. But Jimmy just wasn't a leader, was he? And Ronnie Reagan, leadership just sort of flowed out of his pores. He had a gift of leadership. Or at least he was the right person at the right time, and so there was a very positive effect. And so what leader wouldn't want to win? And competition itself, for all of the downside of it, for all the shadow side of it, competition itself tends to draw out the best in us and can have positive effects as that which is good and strong is elicited from us. So I say all that simply to acknowledge the fact that I recognize it's so easy in preaching to make broad generalizations and absolute statements and forget the subtleties of the subject. And I want you to be aware tonight that I'm aware of the fact that winning is not necessarily a negative. I'm really talking, I suppose, about winning more in the sense of compulsion or obsession. Or maybe the best word to describe what I'm trying to get at tonight is that word drivenness. Have you ever known anyone who is driven? Not necessarily the kind of person you want as your roommate or your life mate, perhaps. That drivenness for perfection, that drivenness to be right, that drivenness to prevail and to be number one. That's the human vice from which, if by God's grace we could be delivered, we would come into so much more of the possibility of humane existence. The grace to let go. And Simon Peter is my victim tonight. He is such a large figure in the Gospels. I cannot talk about Simon Peter without repeating a story that I have repeated here before, and I've done it a couple of times, and I think it's the only story or example or whatever illustration that I ever use that anybody ever remembers. But a few of you have been here long enough perhaps to have heard my sermon on Peter, in which I refer to his nickname. It was Caesarea Philippi and Matthew's construction of the story, the critical, pivotal point of the gospel. And Jesus asks, "Who are they saying I am? And who do you say that I am?" And Peter makes his great confession, "You are the Messiah," or "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus commends him for that, and he says, "You are Peter," which is not really the name Peter. Subsequent to the biblical story, the name Peter has become, of course, a familiar name, and we think of it as a first name, but as a matter of fact, Jesus was saying to him, "You're a rock, you're a stone, you're a rock, and on this rock I'm going to build my church." So, you see, his name really was Simon, huh? Simon Bar-Jonas, which is Simon, son of John. which, as names developed, what we would say about the son of John is that this is Johnson. If you're a Johnson, you're John's son at some point or other. And so what Jesus was really saying to Simon is that from now on, you are Rocky Johnson. Now that's true. It's in the Bible. You are Rocky Johnson. And I think that's such a wonderful nickname because it expresses so well. I mean, shouldn't Rocky Johnson be the name of a prize fighter? Isn't Rocky Johnson the one that would want to go swaggering through life like Arnold Schwarzenegger? Is not Rocky Johnson the exterminator or whatever? A Bruce Willis, as it were? And Peter had that dimension about him. Now, obviously, Jesus was referring to the rock, the foundation of the church. But as a matter of fact, it fit. And the very fact that Peter came forth as a spokesperson for the disciples was indicative of that role that he played. Peter suffered throughout his whole life of foot and mouth disease. He was always blurting out. He was always the first to respond. And he did it impulsively, unreflectively, and without much self-awareness. Peter, there was something about Peter that needed to win and to be first. And he was just this irrepressible member of that disciple band. But Jesus commended him because, as a matter of fact, he had it right. Until Jesus began to explain what his confession meant. And what his confession meant was that Jesus was the one who was going to be crucified. That he was going to Jerusalem, and there he would be crucified. He would be killed. And this didn't take any, this wasn't because Jesus was some kind of a supernatural phantom God walking on earth that he knew all this. It's just simply that it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. Martin Luther King spoke about his imminent death before he was assassinated. And Jesus was well aware of the fact that John the Baptist had just been beheaded. And in the cause that Jesus had taken up, it was obvious that he was setting himself up for a potentially violent end. But it's at that point that Peter, who seemed to be so prescient and so quick to understand, whose confession was so right, at that point Peter revealed that he didn't understand at all. For he said, "Not so, Lord." Now you can't ever really say, "Not so, Lord." If it's Lord, it's so. If it's not so, it's not Lord, huh? Peter said, "Not so, Lord." Because in Peter's mind, this was the Messiah, this was the Christ, and this was the one who was going to triumph. This was the one who would lead Israel out of its bondage and out of its destitution and its humiliation. Peter wanted to go with a winner. And he was convinced that this was God's Messiah, God's anointed one. This was the one through whom God would effect the right and put down the wrong. But what Peter didn't understand was that Jesus' way of winning was through losing. If you want to read a provocative book, perhaps you've seen notices of it. Jack Miles, earlier he wrote the book God, a Biography, which is a literary critic's view of the portrait of God in the Hebrew scriptures, our Old Testament. Very, very interesting. And now he's written the sequel on the New Testament. And the title of it is Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. Now, I say it's one of the most provocative books that I've read in a long, long time. And Jack Miles' thesis is that God was sick and tired of being that God Almighty, Omnipotent One, the warrior God, the warlike God of the Old Testament, and that in Jesus he became human to suffer the ultimate humiliation and to die in order that he might begin again. And the thesis of Jack Miles' understanding of the New Testament or the story of Jesus is that it is the story of the God who wins by losing. Peter had to learn that. And it was obvious that he hadn't learned that. And that all of his blustery affirmation of Jesus and his claim of undying loyal support was only a surface thing, although I'm sure well-intentioned. But he didn't understand that winning might be through losing. Jack Miles refers to Nietzsche, who was scandalized by the Christian gospel. He saw God crucified, God nailed to a cross as a scandal. In his counter myth, The Antichrist, Nietzsche wrote, "What is good? Everything that heightens the feeling of power in man, the will to power, power itself. What is bad? Everything that is born of weakness. What is happiness? The feeling that power is growing, that resistance is overcome. Not contentedness, but power. Not peace, but war. Not virtue, but fitness. The weak and the failures shall perish. What is more harmful than any vice? Active pity for all the failures and all the weak. Christianity." Nietzsche understood Christianity. He understood the Christianity much better than many of the theologians of the 19th century. And he despised that dimension of the gospel that was open to the weakness, that was a story of compassion and of pity. And Nietzsche rebelled against it with a will to power. And he wrote The Antichrist. Well, Peter certainly wasn't a Nietzsche, but he wanted Jesus to win. And he was sure that he would stand with him to the end. And then, of course, as we read, he claims another time, "Although all of these would deny you, I won't." And then, within a few verses in Matthew's story, we have that triple denial and the cock crow and the bitter tears. And the bitter tears, of course, a moment of self-awareness, a saving moment, opening Peter up to the possibility of healing, which indeed came. As John records it, the restoration of Peter. Peter confessed and was commended. He objected and was rebuked. He failed miserably and wept bitterly, and then was restored as Jesus said, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" And Peter said, "Oh God, you know. You know I love you." Can't you identify with him? Have you ever failed miserably? Have you ever wept bitterly? Have you ever heard him say, "Do you love me?" Have you ever said with Peter, "Dear God, you know I love you"? And even then we might say, "Peter, oh Rocky Johnson, you're home free." Not so. It doesn't work that way with us. No matter how poignantly the lessons of life are learned, no matter how deeply imprinted, indelibly imprinted on our souls are those failures and those restorations, nonetheless, we never get beyond the possibility, as Peter demonstrated, of looking around and saying, "What of him? Do you suppose that Peter had been a little bit put off because the disciple that Jesus loved was leaning against his breast at the Last Supper? Wouldn't Peter really want that place?" So Jesus had said, "Peter, you love me? It's as simple as this now. Follow me." But what about him? Peter, what is that to you? Follow me.
Maybe Peter really did learn the lesson Jesus was trying to help him understand. Because in Peter's first letter, he points to Jesus as giving us an example as he endured his suffering. Peter writes that Jesus has left us an example so that we could follow in his steps. Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me." Peter says to us, "Follow in his steps."
You never finally get beyond that compulsion, that obsession, that drivenness that has marked you and marred you. But thank God there is that gracious possibility of restoration. And maybe Peter finally did get it, so that he's given us those wonderful words, "Follow in his steps." The grace to let go, the grace not having always to win, the grace not having always to be right, the grace not having always to appear to be right. I suppose all preaching is finally autobiographical, and I couldn't help but get stopped in my tracks as I'm mulling all this over to have to say, "Richard Rem, you've been a leader, and by God, you've wanted to win." And I was thinking autobiographically about the early years of ministry when I had to live into that role. What an oppressive role, the ministerial role of being right and being righteous, and heavy. And then by the grace of God, falling flat on my face and having all that pretense ripped away, coming back with clay feet hanging out and being able to be human. But in that midlife crisis also, needing to win and prove. And didn't this place explode in the 70s? Growth off the charts. Starting out in that little place over there, 1978, moving into this place, filling it up. And I remember about 1983, I went to a couple of the elders and I said, you know what? I am not comfortable because I am in danger of becoming an entrepreneur of religion. I had been out to Garden Grove and I had heard Robert Schuller preach one Sunday morning. The title was Follow a Winner. And you know who the winner is? It was Jesus. Follow a winner, follow Jesus. And I knew deep down in my heart that there was something terribly wrong with that. Because Jesus was not a winner. And I recognized in what was happening here that need to succeed, and before long success can feed on itself, and the thing that one is building is no longer the thing one is building, but becomes that which is controlling one, huh? And I can remember writing a mission statement, an identity statement for this place, which said, we will swim against the tide if need be. We will not follow the cultural trends in order to grow and prosper and so forth and so on. I can still show you the document. And then as we pursued that path and plateaued for a while, we became even more cognizant of what it meant to follow Jesus, and we began to write down explicitly what that meant. And I can remember those words, we are open to all people no matter of their age or economic status or sexual orientation. And we began to pay for that, didn't we? And we ought not to forget that it was the fact of following Jesus in that, as Luther said, to confess our faith where the battle was raging. It was that that was a presenting cause that brought us into conflict. And as I said to you some months or year ago or whatever, I have been successful now in preaching this place half empty, and if you give me another 10 years, I think I can empty it completely. But you see, this is the struggle. I put it in personal terms, but it's, you can translate it into your own person. That's the struggle. When you see something, when you see the way that you have to go, then do you go that way, no matter what the cost? Which is, I think, what Jesus was trying to say to Peter. What about the church? You ride the crest of popular culture? Or do you hear Jesus say, follow me? And what about the nation? After 9/11? Are we going to get so strong that we can insist on our way anywhere in the world? And will we, with clenched fist, secure this nation? Can't do it, can we? Because the battle is not to the strong, is it? And I don't know how you deal with this on a national level. But I know this, that there is a grace to let go. And by the grace of God, to need not to be number one. By the grace of God, to be set free from drivenness and compulsion and obsessiveness and the swagger that is so much the mark of the hubris of the human being. And Lent is a time when, if we can't solve that global issue, and we can't solve the ecclesiastical issue, at least it's a time on a night like this with an opportunity for self-awareness to say, who am I finally? And why do I do as I do? And in that self-awareness, to come to a kind of freedom in the presence of the God who wins by losing. But you see, if in that self-awareness there's a moment of authenticity before the face of Jesus, then I may lose. But I've already won.